is going to speak to some issues, but mainly we're working on Senate Bill 104, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA. After he's done, we'll go on to hear House Bill 121, Workers' Compensation, and then on to Senate Bill 72, Community Revenue Sharing. With that, Mr. Dickinson, if you could just continue where you left off, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where I left off was the excitement was just building because I was going to go through a step-by-step calculation of how you do IRR. I know everyone could hardly wait. But again, here's a very simple model. I've tried to make everything sort of round to tens over 10 years. What happens, and this is going to be true if you're shipping on a pipeline or if you're buying a machine to produce widgets. In year zero, you go out and you invest. You buy your machine. You build your pipeline. In this case, I'll say you spent $20,000. There's always going to be some operational costs associated with having that asset. And so let's say that we're shipping 1,000 units through this pipeline or we're building 1,000 widgets. And each widget or each unit costs us 10 cents. So every year when we do 1,000 of these units, it's going to cost us $100. And so for years 1 through 10, we're going to have $100 out of our pocket. That, of course, is offset. The reason we bought this machine is we're going to be able to sell our widgets. We're going to be able to sell our gas once we get to the end of the pipeline. And let's, nice round numbers here, I said, let's assume we can sell each unit for $5. So 5 times 1,000, I'm going to get in $5,000. We add all that up, and what you see in the last column is, in year zero, I pay out $20,000, I get my machine, I get my pipeline built, and then in each of the next 10 years, I have a positive cash flow of $4,900. And what I did on the very bottom of this was simply go into Excel, and you ask it for there's a rate of return function, and it says, cranks it through and says, okay, that comes out to a 21% rate of return. It looked at how much investment I made and how much I made back in each successive year, and it valued the far-out cash flows a little bit less than the near-in cash flows. That's a 21% rate of return. Now, what if I said, gosh, instead of buying that machine, I'm going to lease that machine? Or I'm going to just make a firm transportation commitment, and someone else is going to build the pipeline, and then I'm going to pay him back with the tariff. Well, first of all, you have to figure out when you lease the machine or you take a firm transportation commitment, how much are you going to pay every year? And again, you go in and the black box there, I have another function that you can do in Excel. And those of you who have played with mortgages and things like that have probably used it. But you say, if I have $20,000 and I need to pay that off over 10 years and I put an arbitrary interest rate in there of 10%, how much payment do I have to make each year? And the answer is $3,254.91. And all this table shows is if indeed I make that payment and there's 10% interest, and if there's 10% interest accrues, then at the end of those 10 years, I will have paid off that note. So what's going to happen? What does my modeling look like for my rate of return? So what I'm going to do is I still have this column here that has the $100 in it because my operational costs are still going to be there. Then we derived a $3,254.91 annual charge. I add those two together. I get $3,354.90. That's how much I'm going to have to pay out every year. I'm still selling my 5,000 widgets and getting in $5,000. And so the net of that is I make $1,645 a year, and I do that for 10 years. And then I go into Excel and I say, gosh, Excel, can you calculate the rate of return on that? And the answer is no, it can't. If you just have a positive series of cash flows, your rate of return is infinite. If you're trying to evaluate whether to do something, and the answer is, yeah, you get money in every year, then of course the answer is yes, you do it. And trying to compare that to some other thing, you're not capital constrained, it didn't cost you anything. The answer is, if you've got a series of positive cash flows, that gives you an infinite rate of return. Excuse me. And what I'm going to suggest is, essentially, the underlying calculation where you get those 80 and 90% rate of returns on the pipeline are because you've essentially done this calculation. You've ignored the fact that the producer had to make an FT commitment, And you said, all I'm going to do is look at their tariff that goes out and their cash that comes in from selling it. Now, of course, it'd be ridiculous if someone came to you and said, hey, the pipeline has an infinite rate of return. So what you do in the next slide is you put in some upstream costs. Now, let's look at Prudhoe Bay. As I went through this morning, if folks can remember, at Prudhoe Bay, you got 8 billion cubic feet a day being put down on the ground. It's already been processed. All it needs is a little bit of treatment to put it in a pipeline. So let's say the producer said, okay, we'll ship on a third-party pipeline, but that pipeline needs to be built all the way up to our existing facilities. You need to literally bolt on to the existing central gas plant or central compression plant. There'll be no capital outlays. Well, that would be a rate of return for the producers that would be infinite. And in this example, let's say there's a couple of hookup costs. Yeah, you gotta weld some things in place, so you'll still get a very, very high rate of return. In this case, 1,645% rate of return, a ridiculous rate of return. So you can put in more capital costs, and as you put in more capital costs, for example, at Point Thompson, you don't already have the gas ready to go into a pipeline. You have to develop the entire field, so there's going to be billions of dollars of costs. You put those in, and again, your rate of return drops. And the final slide that I'm showing here shows just how much capital cost you'd have to put in to bring it back down to a rate of return of 21%, which was what it was calculated, if you remember, on the original project. My point is, if you take the FT commitment and you say that is zero effect on a producer's finances, and you compare that to a situation in which the producer lays all the cash out, you're going to get a position where you're going to find that you create these absolutely fabulous rates of return. And the answer is, that's not an appropriate analysis. If that analysis were appropriate, then the state, we could just end all this nonsense now. The state could step forward and say, we'll make the FT commitment. If it really doesn't affect our finances, if it doesn't affect our credit rating, if we can promise everyone that their dividends won't be affected, why not do it? The state should step forward and do this riskless thing and do the FT commitment. But if, in fact, making an FT commitment needs to be reflected and needs to be dealt with to analyze the situation correctly, it's not a question of if. It is necessary to do that. If you simply ignore that FT commitment, you're not analyzing the situation correctly. Now, what I'd like to do is spend a minute and talk about the Financial Accounting Standards Board and go back a quarter of a century to the late 70s and the early 80s. And this is when leasing and things like that first started appearing, what was called off-sheet balance financing. And lots of people were doing off-sheet balance financing, and the big split was that the Financial Accounting Standards Board said, wait a minute, you need folks who are analyzing you, who are looking at your financial statements and want to hear from us that they fairly represent the condition of the company, this off-sheet balance stuff needs to show up. People aren't getting a fair picture. And so what FASB 47 was, is they said, this statement requires that an enterprise disclose its commitment under unconditional obligations that are associated with suppliers' financing arrangements. We want to say such obligations often are in the form of take-or-pay contracts and throughput contracts. And that's exactly what an FT commitment is. It's a commitment that you will deliver gas to this pipeline, and if you don't, you will pay anyway. And as early as 25 years ago, folks said, the Financial Accounting Standard Board said, this is going to become a generally accepted accounting principle that this has to be disclosed. I'm going to skip the entire body of FASB 47 and skip right all the way to paragraph 27. And if folks want to look up the other 26 paragraphs, I'll be glad to go through them with you. But the point is, here's the example that FASB used, and it's absolutely right on. And so I'm going to break the rule, and I'm going to do a PowerPoint presentation by putting this stuff up here and reading it. But the point is, this is absolutely on point. This is from FASB writing now. Paragraph 27 of their FASB 47 says, C Company has entered into a throughput agreement with a natural gas pipeline, providing that C will provide specified quantities of natural gas, representing a portion of capacity, for transportation through the pipeline each period while the debt used to finance the pipeline remains outstanding. And they're exactly describing an FT commitment. The tariff, approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, contains two provisions, a demand charge and a commodity charge. The demand charge is computed to cover debt service, depreciation, and certain expected expenses. And moving on to the next slide. The commodity charge is intended to cover other expenses and provide a return on the pipeline company's investment. C company must pay the demand charge based on the contract quantity, regardless of actual quantity shipped, while the commodity charge is applied to actual quantity shipped. Accordingly, the demand charge multiplied by the contracted quantity represents a fixed and determinable amount. And for those of you who are up on accounting buzzwords, if you have a fixed and determinable amount that you owe, you need to disclose it. So, FASB, go on to paragraph 28, next paragraph. And FASB writes, C's disclosure might be, I probably skipped an S there, but C's disclosure might be as follows. C company has signed an agreement providing for the availability of needed transportation capacity through 1990. And of course, when they were writing, that was way out in the future. Under that agreement, the company must make specified minimum payments monthly. The aggregate amounts of such required payments at December 31st, 19X1 is as follows in thousands. And they give a little table, so you show each of the next 5 years. You then show how much is in the later years. You sum it all up, calculate the present value of it, so you're not taking into an interest component into account, and you present, here's the amount that I owe in present value. That's what FASB said you have to do. Okay, and then there's some further requirements that are in there for completeness, but they're not relevant. Let's skip to an annual financial statement from BP. This was an additional handout. Actually, the handout has a page from BP's financial disclosures, a page from Conoco's, and a two-page set from Exxon's. This is BP's up here, and I'm actually not going to ask people to read it here, but the very bottom line of that table is for unconditional purchase obligations and footnote D. And in the next slide here, here's what that says. Unconditional purchase obligations. These represent any agreement to purchase goods or services that is enforceable and legally binding and that specifies all significant terms. The amounts shown include arrangements to secure long-term access to supplies of crude oil, natural gas feedstocks, and, I can't really see up there, but this is in red, and to pipeline systems. So this is where an FT commitment is going to go in their financial books. And as you can see here, I'll go back. Just like FASB says they do, that you set it out for 5 years, you go ahead, you calculate the sum, the years after that, you do the total. So this is what FASB says they needed to do, and this is what they do. This is what they have to, they're obligated to disclose in order to give a fair accounting of their company's position and finances. Okay, who cares? I mean, I care because I'm a CPA, I care what FASB says. Why should anybody else care? And the answer is, what FASB is trying to do is make sure that people evaluating financial statements are getting a fair look at what the company is doing. And who evaluates financial statements? And what I've got here is a document from Moody's. And Moody's, as you know, sells their services. If you're about to do business with a company and you want to understand that company's finances, you want to know how creditworthy they are, that's what you hire Moody's to do. And Moody lists the authors of this article. They also call them contacts. I mean, this is clearly a document where they're selling their expertise. And this document was called An Analysis of Off-Balance Sheet Exposures, A Global Perspective. And it's from a couple of years ago, July 2004. And here's what Moody says about take-or-pay contracts. Take-or-pay contracts are another form of purchase commitment typically found in the energy industry. And that's what we're talking about here. Such contracts can be problematic if market conditions and raw material prices change, or if the price of the end product drops. Regardless of whether or not the contract becomes problematic, Moody's factors payments under take-or-pay contracts into the analysis of future cash flows and may also adjust the balance sheet if necessary. In other words, when they look at a take-or-pay commitment, when they look at an FT commitment, they don't even just say, well, gosh, what would happen if gas prices went to $1 and you didn't want to make a $2 payment? Even if the structuring is not troubled, under the financial commitment that you've made, Moody's is going to go in and figure out how to have that reflected in your analysis of the company. Standard & Poor's, another one of the big three raters, and they again have their authors, or in this case they call them their analytic contacts, corporate ratings criteria, and this was published last year, 2006. What do they say? They have a section entitled Off-Balance Sheet Financing. And here's what they say. Analysis of liabilities is not limited to those shown on the company's balance sheet. Off-balance sheet items factored into the leverage analysis include the following. They go through several, and then they say, take or pay contracts and obligations under throughput and deficiency agreements. This is exactly what they're talking about. And how do they analyze them? They say various methodologies are used to determine the proper adjustment value for each off-balance sheet item. In some cases, the adjustment is straightforward. For example, the amount of guaranteed debt can simply be added to the guarantor's liabilities. Other adjustments are more complex or less precise. In other words, hire us and we'll deal with the complexities. The point is, one way of dealing with this IRR is simply as I did in my very first example. If you sign an FT commitment, you capitalize the present value of that, you stick that in the cash flow. I don't know if that's appropriate here or not. I'm not an analyst. I can tell you that under accounting rules, this stuff has to be disclosed because it's absolutely critical to understand a company's finances. And then people using that disclosure have to use their judgments to correctly analyze how to best do it. But I can guarantee you in almost every case, ignoring it is not the way to do it. And I think the suggestion is if you've generated a rate of return by ignoring it, it seems fabulous. Maybe the analysis needs to include that FT commitment and figure out just what that FT commitment means. I'm going to finish up here with a closing thought. Mr. Chairman, I think I'm under my half hour. And this is from an article in the Society of Petroleum Engineers. Again, it stems from that same period when off-balance sheet financing was being discussed a lot. And I'm not trying to mock anyone's analysis. I think what this is, in a journal not known for its humor, it's someone trying to deal with how companies internally, how these projects surface and how folks deal with those projects internally. So here's the quote. Now and then, someone comes in and announces that he has discovered the businessman's equivalent to the fountain of youth, a corporate money tree. That person will instruct us that his pet project need not compete for cash in the budgeting process because he has found a benefactor, Mr. S. Claus, willing to put up the money at no cost save some small monthly payments to be worked out later, i.e., there's a way of financing this with only tariff payments later on. These payments should come from the pet project's profits and represent no real drain on the company. Quote continues, to be sure, we seldom see requests as blatant as portrayed above, but we nevertheless sense some misunderstandings about how to evaluate projects that have alternatives to outright purchase of goods and equipment. Has the old maxim prohibiting free lunches somehow been set aside with regard to so-called creative financing? No, more likely the lunch costs more than normal and we're not always sure who pays. I don't know about the last couple of sentences there, but this is the point I'm trying to make with this quotation and with the other development is, this is an error that folks make when they look at IRR. It's supposed to be based on cash flows, but you need to look at opportunity costs. You need to look at everything when you're doing that analysis. And to answer the specific question that I was asked, I believe this was not done in the material that you were presented, and that's why you see rates of return of 20, 30, 40, 50%. I don't think this project generates those kinds of rates of return, and I hope this analysis showed the way to correctly analyze it and probably get a more appropriate rate of return. But thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my analysis of these four questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dickinson.
Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. So just two questions, and I think they're relatively quick. Dan, when anybody analyzes the liability of an FT commitment, I mean, do they factor in the likelihood of that liability? I'm going to make an assumption. You can tell me whether it's correct or not. The liability comes, there is only liability if there's a negative netback. Is that a fair statement?
Senator Elton, through the chair, no. There are situations in which without a negative netback, you would still be having to step in and make those payments. If some interruption in the flow occurred and you weren't able to tender the full amount, there are other situations in which that could occur. One, the one you've identified would certainly be a plausible scenario as to why, but I don't believe it's the only one.
But if there is a, I'm sorry, Mr.
Go ahead.
But if there is a pause in the flow that creates a negative netback, you're paying for something that you're not delivering, and so you're not making money on it.
Center out through the chair. If that's what you mean by netback, yes.
Okay. And when Standard & Poor or Moody's does an evaluation, I mean, doesn't that evaluation have to include the possibility that you get to a negative netback? And how do you, and so it's not, it, there is a value or a judgment call that's made. It's not just made on numbers on a sheet, is it?
Senator Alton, through the chair. No, you're correct, and that's, in fact, if I go back to the quote from Moody's, they talk about of, you know, whether it's troubled or not, you need to analyze it correctly. And let me expand on this, and maybe this may be helpful. If I have a guarantee, if I stack up a bunch of guarantees, at some point, my creditworthiness is no longer as high. In other words, what's called a balance sheet impairment. So if I have a credit guarantee that is never used, you know, then the analysis can be, gosh, then that was zero cost to me. But beforehand, if you're looking at a series of these or the possibilities, what you're trying to figure out is how creditworthy under various circumstances is this company. And so one of the effects that will occur, one of the costs to a company in underwriting debt is precisely the cost of balance sheet impairment. Let me again perhaps talk about the debate. I think that this is where you're going with this. Back in the 1980s, or when this was controversial, the companies came and said, gosh, look, we only undertake projects as we expect them to be profitable. The cost of this lease will be clearly covered by the jet dollars that we generate. We don't need to disclose this. We're, you know, everything's hunky-dory. The two will offset. And if you look on the BP document that was handed out, they, in fact, after revealing their unconditional purchase obligations, they say, in the footnote D, they say, oh, but go ahead, and the risk associated with these contracts is discussed in a separate item. And so what I believe they're going to say, I don't actually have this in front of me, but they're going to say, gosh, look, here are the, you know, if gas prices stay at $5, we'll never have to, you know, use this FT, we'll never have to make those payments. All that's happening, you know, don't worry your head about this, this is fine. And again, my analogy is, if that's true, then if it really is, if the only risk is simply that it's not going to be paid, the state ought to take on that risk. There is an actual impairment simply by issuing a financial instrument, signing a contract that says we're going to make these payments for the next 20 years. That represents a real cost to a company.
And kind of the last question, it's kind of where I was trying to get to. I've been told, and maybe it's not correct, but I've been told that the way Mr. Scott got at his numbers is the same way, using a lot of the same assumptions that Conoco got to theirs in their most recent 10-K filing. If that's the case, I mean, have you run your own numbers to see, you know, what the IRR is, I mean, using your assumptions, or?
Senator Elton, through the chair, no, I haven't, and I quite frankly am not an analyst who does this for a living. I'm an accountant, pointing out what the accounting disclosures are, and I'm trying to understand, explain why those items need to be disclosed, and if they really need to be disclosed, I'm troubled that somebody says, but I'm not going to use them, doesn't help me analyze this company. On your earlier comment, I have no idea. I mean, you'd have to be more explicit about which number. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if 99% of the numbers were identical to the ones that Conoco uses. I assume that they would go and look at them and plug in the same thing. So I don't know what specific figure you're talking about. I mean, a financial, there's no disclosed rates of return. It's not like there's this 90 or 80% shows up in a financial document for Conoco that says the pipeline have a 90% rate of return. But I believe the costs and their cost of capital, things like that, the cost of certain debt, yeah, that's all going to be the same in both analyses. So maybe I don't understand your question, but I don't know what specific numbers you're referring to that are quote the same.
And Mr. Chair, I may be inarticulate in my question. I guess where I'm having a problem is I'm being told that you can't trust his numbers. I've been told that he's using many of the same assumptions and the same approach that ConocoPhillips did. And I don't see anybody coming forward with their own numbers. I mean, we're hearing a lot about his numbers being wrong. His assertion is that while we're using a lot of the same stuff that ConocoPhillips did in their 10K, and people are taking shots at him, but I'm not seeing other numbers.
Fair enough. And through the chair, Senator Elton, I guess the analogy is my understanding. I'm way off base here. You know, a fly and a human being have 97% the same 97% of the DNA is the same, but the other 3% is critical. I'm assuming that, in fact, you would find lots of things in common, but I can pretty much, without looking at it, I'd be a little hesitant, I pretty much guarantee you won't find in a ConocoPhillips document a rate of return analysis that suggests ignoring